All right. Hi, Zoom people. I'm Ashley. I'm an alcoholic. I'll just start with the stats and then we'll kind of get into it, I guess. But my sobriety date is January 30th of 2000. I have a home group. It's a Tuesday night Newmarket group. It is near Frederick, Maryland. I actually live on the Montgomery County side, but it's up there. So if you're ever up there, come on out. It's Tuesday nights at 7:30. It's a great meeting. I also have a sponsor who used to be a member of that home group, but she has since moved to Tennessee and she's still my sponsor. And I probably talk to her more now than I did when she was local, which is a good thing. I do talk to her and she knew I was coming here tonight and was really excited to hear that. So it's such a, I will just say, you know, I mean, Thanksgiving, November, gratitude, we call it gratitude month up near us. A lot of times it's 11 step meetings. We're talking about prayer, all this stuff. And it was just crazy how I came to this meeting tonight because I just so happened to see Billy and Lynn at a retreat in October. And he asked me to come tonight. And my sister has a place in Etland, 20 minutes up the road. And I mean, I'm 2 hours plus away from here. And, you know, and I would have come. I mean, I'm going to drive 2 hours, so that's fine. But it just was amazing how I got to be here today. And the big difference about today, come on in, Casey. I hope it's okay. I'm just going to let people, okay. Come on in. I think the big difference with today is I had one of the best days ever just hanging out in my sister's place by myself. I mean, I don't get to be by myself a whole lot, and we'll hear about that in a little bit. But when I came to Alcoholics Anonymous, if I was by myself, which was really all the time, I had kind of burned a lot of bridges and all that. But I really just wanted to die. Like I could not stand being by myself where I was at with nothing to make me feel better. But I just had just this grand day today. And I'm excited to drive home and blare music and do all sorts of, and I just enjoyed life today. And I did not at all when I got here. So how I kind of got here and, you know, Billy read page 29. So I also want to kind of describe not just my story about getting out to Alcoholics Anonymous, but also describe my spiritual journey and what's happened. I mean, that's the big thing. That's why we're here. And we don't shy away from talking about it. But before I got here, I really had no spiritual anything. I was somebody who I have an older sister. She's the one that has the place in Etland, and it was just her and I, and my parents split when I was pretty young. And my mom is, I didn't have alcoholism in my home, like in my immediate family. But my mom is severely mentally ill. And so that just caused its own dysfunction in the house. And so, my sister really ended up kind of raising me and my mom was just not well and checked out for the majority of my upbringing. So I mean, my first drink was 13. I'm with my sister. Because I didn't know what else to do. I didn't know how to make friends. It was very awkward. Even before alcohol, I was in elementary school making lists of who I wanted to my funeral. I was just this really dark kid, you know, and I found alcohol and that was a blessing. I mean, it was amazing. My first drink was grain alcohol. I would have drank anything you gave me. And so I did, you know, and I did not, you know, drink every day right after. I drank as often as I could after that, which often was weekends. I grew up in Northern Virginia. So I learned pretty quickly that if you were female, you could get any kind of fake ID you wanted to and get in just about anywhere. And so I would go to DC and go to clubs and bars. It started with clubs because that was really fun, but then I didn't have the energy and I really just wanted to drink. I didn't care about having fun. I just cared about drinking. So I would, you know, hang out at the bars in DC. I kind of graduated from, you know, dating the bouncers to dating the bartenders. It was much more beneficial to be dating the bartender. I mean, of course you needed to get in, but once you were in, I mean, you kind of needed to be able to supply your things. So, I mean, I just kind of did whatever. I was somebody who I didn't hang out with people in my school. I didn't like school. I was made fun of a lot and I really didn't like school at all. And, so I just was in my sister's back pocket also for kind of throughout school. I started working when I was 13, and mainly because she was working and I wanted to do whatever she was doing. I worked at Domino's Pizza for 10 years. And hung out with all the people that worked there. You know, I mean, I hung out with the older drivers, you know, I'd be kind of in the shop making pieces, answering phones, doing all that. And I would hang out with all the people older. And so I had an easy access to getting alcohol. I was often the youngest person who was hanging out. So when people were arrested, I was often told, well, just go on home, you know, which is kind of funny now because I feel like it's gotten so much stricter. But I thought it was strict back then, but I still was being told just to kind of go home. I started kind of sacrificing things for drinking, probably really in high school. I really drank very heavily in high school. And I would skip school. I didn't like school, so I just wouldn't go. I wasn't like this class clown person. I was just like, well, why go? Let me just not go. So I would show up on like test days, but they had just made this rule like you couldn't miss X number of days or you wouldn't graduate or wouldn't go the next year. And I like blew way past that, but I don't think they really knew how to count them at least yet. And I didn't cause trouble, so they just let me keep going. So I was pretty good at this sport. I was really good at softball. I mean, I played in travel leagues, did all this stuff. And I was, you know, freshman year, I was varsity. And I mean, I was doing things, you know. And the coach was telling me, hey, look, we got these scouts coming out. I was the only, you know, sophomore, junior where scouts were coming to look for at me and stuff like that. And by junior year, I was at the bar so much and I wasn't going to school. I mean, I didn't think the rules applied to me. I mean, I did not think that I was not going to play if I didn't show up to school. And she wouldn't play me. And I thought, well, I don't know why you would do. I mean, you guys are going to, I was so arrogant, you know? And, but she wouldn't play me. And by senior year, I had been partying so hard this whole time. I was not in good shape at all. And, I went to the first practice senior year and I thought she had it out for me. And really what it was is I was so unhealthy. I mean, I could not withstand a practice and I was like, forget it, I quit. And I just never played again. I did end up playing years later with my sister, but that was a whole nother story. So I took kind of I, the other things that's kind of started happening, I did not realize it's crazy to me that I did not think this was a problem at the time. But there were so many things that were happening, and I was hanging around with such people where things seemed normal. You know, it's only alcoholism and the life that I had created was the only normal that I knew. And so, you know, I thought that it was normal that I had this crazy mom. I thought that it was normal that, you know, I was going into bars and clubs and, you know, all this stuff. I thought it was normal that everyone around me was getting arrested and I wasn't. I thought it was normal that I was 16 and getting pregnant, you know? And, you know, I went spring break. I still to this day don't know who I was in a blackout and I get pregnant and get back and I'm like, well, this wasn't part of the plan. Just terminate the pregnancy. I mean, I was with other women that had been doing the same thing. And I just thought, well, I got to be more careful next time, you know? And I really didn't know how to take care of myself at all. And so I didn't, that didn't bother me. I mean, that's insane to me now, you know? But I just kept doing whatever folks around me were doing, and it was no big deal. And so I get to college, and college was a strange place for me. It was kind of my first geographic. It was my first time away from home. And I went to school in Pittsburgh. And I really kind of learned at that time, like how to be angry. I kind of re-recognized that I'm not good at making friends. And I sort of found people, you know, initially I found people that partied, but at the same time, I had this idea in my mind that if I did well at school, then no one could give me a hard time about my behavior. And I had felt that way in high school, and I still got good grades in high school. Like I would show up and do well on tests, even though I hadn't been there. I mean, it was kind of nuts. But college, I couldn't do that anymore. I mean, it was hard, and I was taking hard classes, and I really couldn't. So I would white knuckle it for like a month, and just kind of not drink for a month, and then I would drive home and I would party with my old party people, and then I'd go back to school, and then I'd have like several month periods of like Christmas holiday or, you know, winter holiday where it's like a month long, and then spring or excuse me, summer holiday where it's like 3 months long, and I would be blacked out the whole time. So by the time I was getting near the end of college, I was having a bit of a panic because people were kind of, they knew what they wanted to do in life. They were getting, they were behaving like adults. And I was not, nor did I want to. I mean, I didn't want to be an adult. I didn't want to be responsible for anything. I didn't understand how people could do that. I didn't understand how people could wake up on time every day for a job, like a regular job, like where you wake up in the morning. I didn't understand that. I mean, I could do it like once, but I couldn't do it on a consistent basis. I'm like, how do people do that for like 10 years? I don't know how you do that. So I had developed this scheme. I was always kind of scheming and planning. We do that, and I thought, well, I don't know what I want to do, and I know I don't want anyone to give me a hard time, and I know I want to keep doing whatever I want to do with no consequences. Shocker. And so I decide, you know what, let me go to school forever. That's what I'll do. I'll just figure out some kind of school where I could go to school forever. People would feel sorry for me because I'm a student, and oh my gosh, I don't have any money. I don't know who I thought would feel sorry for me. I mean, I didn't have anybody in my life that was that way. No one was feeling sorry for me, except for me. So when I was growing up, we played this board game Life, and there were two professions that required a lot of school, and you were in school forever. And if you went around the board, you would get the most amount of money. It was $50,000 if you were a lawyer or if you were a doctor. And I thought, this is literally how this thought process went. I don't really like history, but I'm really good at math. Maybe I should be a doctor because then I could just be in school forever. And that's respectable because, now I don't have the resume to be a doctor, to go to med school. I don't have any of that. Okay. But I start building my schemes and plans. And so I graduate from school and I'm like, all right, I'm gonna go work for the National Institutes of Health for a couple years. I'll get my resume built up. I'll apply for med school. Easy peasy. So I go back and I live with my mom. It's me and my mom. I'm 21 years old. By that time, I had sacrificed many values. And if I had any, they were gone. I mean, I had been a stripper in college to make money for drinking. And I make these weird rules. In my mind, the rule is if I don't drink while dancing, I'm fine, but I save all my money for alcohol and to party. But I'm not putting myself in a vulnerable position if I'm not intoxicated while I'm dancing. So, that lasted a certain amount of time. And I wasn't very good at it because, I'm somebody who's an eating drunk. So what that means is that I get overweight real quick. I mean, I don't pass a beat. I'm somebody who I saturate myself with booze and then I try and soak it up with food. So, I'd gain 20 pounds in a month. So my agent's like, look, you can't dance anymore. Which is awful. And I'm like, okay, whatever. That's a sign. It's a sign. But I'm not even, I'm not somebody who did that for years. I mean, 6 months, right? So, but I don't care. I'm just going on and on doing whatever. So I get home, I'm living with my mom, and I don't have something to get back to with purpose, like, which is what school did for me, where I like would not drink for this brief period of time. I can't believe I have ha had any control over it. I really can't believe that there would be like a month where I wouldn't drink. It was fascinating in looking back. But I came home and essentially for the last 2 years of my drinking, I drank every day. And I didn't think that when I got sober. And I didn't think that because I had gotten to the point in my last 2 years of drinking that I had started to develop liver failure at 23. And so what that meant is that I would often, in an unpredictable way, get very ill. And would not be able to anticipate if I was going to get sick. And so I would end up taking a day off from drinking. It was usually Wednesdays because I was right in the middle. But my body just couldn't tolerate putting alcohol in it anymore. So there'd usually be one day a week that I wouldn't drink. I'm like, I didn't drink every day. Drink six days, not seven. And that was my kind of, well, I don't connect with these people that drink every day, which is so crazy, liver failure. Okay. So I start, I'm not a minor anymore, and I start catching charges, start getting arrested for various things. This was before 9/11, but the Pentagon is still federal property. And it's a shortcut if you have to go. I had this place where I would go to pass out, essentially. It was like this bachelor pad. There were these three guys, they were my drinking buddies. And I'd always kind of end up back at their place and just crash out there. I did not drink in my mom's home, so I really was rarely there. I would just stay at these guys' house and their apartment. And so the short goes through the Pentagon, and had federal charges for DWI, which is different, I'm going to tell you. And then, within, and I just thought, well, everyone had had their DWI, so it's my turn, you know? And within 3 months, I got another DWI. And that time I went to jail, which I did not like. And I actually thought, I don't know why I thought this, but again, I get these weird thoughts and then like this peculiar mental twist that I have. And I think, well, but I've graduated college. Like they're not going to put me in jail. They don't care. They don't ask for your resume when they're arresting you. Like none of that, you know? And they put me in jail. And so I call the only person I know to call. And that's the one girlfriend that I had left. And this was a girl who I really didn't like women at all. Shocker. I'm a woman. Like, you know,
Sure.
make that connection. But I really didn't like women. I was not, I didn't identify myself as like a stereotypical woman. I didn't like to get all done up. I shouldn't, I didn't like women. There's this one woman, and the reason I liked her so much is because she was like a tough broad. Like she was played for the rugby team, you know, and she just was no nonsense. She probably could have taken me too. I mean, she was impressive. And she was going to law school. And so I was like, okay, like she's got something going for her, you know. So I call her, Jane, call her when I'm in jail. I was like, dude, yeah, they picked me up. Hey, I need you to come pick me up. So she comes pick me up. She takes me to some greasy spoon diner, and which is exactly what I needed for my hangover. And she started telling me about her father, who had 28 years sober and Alcoholics Anonymous. And I didn't understand why she was telling me about her dad. I was very confused, and I was confused because I drank with Jane. Why is she telling? Is she going to A? She's not going to A. Why is she telling me about her sober dad? You know, but this is the first time anyone has ever mentioned Alcoholics Anonymous to me. And so I'm scared, did not like jail. And I'm like, you know what? I probably shouldn't drink and drive. So let me, and I don't know when I'm going to be driving. So let me just not drink for a little bit. I could not do that without using other substances. I really could not do that in a sober fashion. And it was almost my birthday, so I had to drink for my birthday. By that point, I was going to court, and I was sentenced to a year of probation, this court-ordered intensive outpatient program for alcoholism. And then that, I did not think this was fair. The judge ordered me a certain sentence, and then the rehab tacked on to the sentence. I didn't think that was fair. He already gave me my punishment. You know, I got to like go to inpatient, or excuse me, intensive outpatient rehab. Well, they then sentenced me to X number of AA meetings. So there were three numbers of AA meetings. You either got one meeting, six meetings, or 12 meetings you had to go to. That's it. I was the only one in the group that got 12. I was like, what is happening? Like, why do people have it out for me? You know? And I was so upset by all this. And I just felt like things are not ever going to get better. They just keep getting worse and worse. I don't know what I'm going to do. And so then we get around to Y2K. And I don't know what it was like for you all for Y2K. Again, I hung out with some pretty interesting people. And we all convinced ourselves that the world was going to end because the computers would not know what they were going to do with the Y2K business. And so we decided that we would just rent a cabin in the middle of nowhere in West Virginia and go out for like a bender because we're all going to die because the computers are going to shut the world down. We disinvited somebody because we needed to fit more liquor. I mean, we just didn't care, you know? So I go on this bender in Y2K, 99 going into 2000. And I'm going to tell you what, January 2nd, I got piss tested by my PO. And I did not think that was fair. I thought you got a pass. I thought, New Year's, come on. I mean, who stays sober for New Year's? So he, called me into his office, and, I gave some racket, like, "Well, I was in a phone booth and this," and I mean, it was just a bunch of shenanigans that I was trying to tell him. It's a bunch of BS. And so he's like, "Listen, I just save your time. I don't believe anything you're telling me. I don't actually even care. This is your one get out of jail free card. If you come up dirty again, jail for a year. That's it. We're not playing this." And I was freaked out. And so it's the beginning of January. I'm like, oh my gosh. So I can't do anything, nothing. And I could not last more than 3 days. And by this point, I'd be alone. I'd be in the apartment. I say alone. My mom was in the apartment, but I wasn't talking to her, you know. We would just hole up in our rooms, you know. And by this point, as far as any kind of spiritual anything, so I mentioned my mom is severely mentally ill. So what would happen is she would get very sick and she would get hyper religious and she would send a whole bunch of money to the 700 Club on TV. And our lights would get cut off, the car would get repossessed. And I was like, I don't want to have anything to do with this. I mean, I figured religion, God, spirituality, first of all, I thought it was all the same, which I now don't believe that to be true, but I felt like it was either for poor people or crazy people, and I really didn't want either. And my mom was both. And so I kind of had this my kind of my moment of clarity was January of 2000, and I'm sitting there, and my mom had always said everything's going to be all right. You just got to trust that everything's going to be all right. And I knew she's crazy. And everything's not going to be all right. And it was the first time I realized that everything is not going to be all right. And I did start praying every night, and I prayed that I would die in my sleep every night. So couldn't last more than a few days. I'm realizing, okay, I got to be going to these ANA meetings, whatever those are. And I felt behind. I don't know when they were due, but I felt like I was behind. I hadn't gone to any yet. And so I'm like, you know what, I got to start forging these court slips at least. So, but I thought the judge was, I don't know why I thought he was so interested in me, like he was following me or like my phones were tapped or that he was going to follow up on what I did, but I thought all of that to be true. And so, I decided to call Alcoholics Anonymous. I was going to be going to Colorado with my dad. And I decided, you know what, let me call and find out what some AA meetings are in Colorado, and I'll forge the signatures because I don't think the judge is going to have connections out in Colorado. So I called AA in Colorado, and this was my first interaction with someone for myself in, you know, with Alcoholics Anonymous. And this woman said, I was telling her, "Hey, I'm looking for a meeting." Whatever, and she said, "Well, you're looking for an open meeting or a closed meeting?" And I was like, "I don't really know what you're talking about. And she said, "Well, do you have a desire to stop drinking?" And I had never thought about it. I mean, I really, to that point, I thought, well, maybe I'm depressed. Maybe I'm this. Maybe it's because I have a crazy mom. Maybe, I mean, I just had not thought about that stopping drinking or that alcoholism. I really did not think that was the problem. And so, but then I thought my phones were tapped. So I said, "Yes, I have a desire to stop drinking," because I knew that the judge did not want me drinking. And so she said, "Okay, well, you can go to whatever meeting you want. Closed meeting is for people that have a desire to stop drinking. Open meeting, anybody can go to, students, family member, whatever." So I forged my slip for Colorado. And then I was like, you know, I've been to school. I've been to a lot of school. I had graduated from college. I can't believe I graduated college. And so I felt like it was just like another quiz. I thought the judge was going to give me a quiz on AA to know that I'd gone, even though I had these slips. So I was like, well, I got to go to one AA meeting. So by this point, the what happened for me was that, so I had mentioned I'm somebody that does not typically like to really feel anything of right here and right now. I'm not comfortable in my own skin. So I'll take anything that's on the table. And alcohol happens to be my primary thing, but it could be whatever. And so by that point, I had also developed a little bit of a gambling problem. Because, you know, why not? And it was about to be Super Bowl weekend. And I'm a football girl. My dad played football for University of Alabama for Bear Bryant, and I grew up in a football family. And so I saw my bookie in a blackout. It was like a brownout, you know, because
No.
I remember seeing him, and then that's it. And I came to in that apartment with the guys. The guy, I don't even know if they were there, but I was there. I had a key to the place. And I woke up and came to in a pool of vomit and recalled that I had seen the bookie and panicked because I didn't know what I'd bet on. I didn't know if I bet on over, the under, what did I, you know, I had no idea. And almost at the same, this is all kind of foggy, but I feel like this all happened in a matter of a couple hours. I'm sure that's not true, but that's how I remember it. I get a call that my buddy that I'd been drinking with at the bar the night before, he'd gotten pulled over. He got pulled over for his third DWI, whatever. And he blew a .42, so they took him to the hospital, not straight to central booking. And I was like, oh, that's how I drink. I mean, we drink head for head. I mean, that's how I drink. And then my sister called me. And my sister and my mom had been going to Al-Anon because they didn't know what to do with me. They've been going to Al-Anon for like 6 months. And my sister called me and she said, hey, listen, just so you know, there's an AA meeting upstairs from the Al-Anon meeting. And just so you know, Lisa's brother, Brian, is in the AA meeting and he's looking really good. You should go check him out. Now, I mentioned I was an eating drunk. So by this point, I have liver failure. I'm approaching, and so I'm like an orangish hue. And I'm approaching 300 pounds. And I thought to myself, let's go check out Brian. Let's go. I knew I had to go to one meeting, and I'm going to pass the A quiz that the judge is going to give me, right? So Tuesday, it was a Tuesday night meeting in McLean, Virginia. And mom and my sister went to Al-Anon. I go upstairs to the A meeting. It's February 1st of 2000. And my sobriety date's January 30th of 2000. So it had been 2 days and I hadn't drank. And a whole bunch of young people there. Was actually kind of weird. The weirdest part about the meeting for me is that everyone seemed excruciatingly, painfully happy. I mean, it was painful. I mean, it made me feel like I was an alien. I did not feel like I belonged at all when I came to my first AA meeting. I actually felt like if you all had what I have, you would not be so happy. I don't know what's gotten into you all. So I go to this meeting. A whole bunch of ladies came up to me after the I don't like women, but they all came up to me, but kind of bum rushed me after the meeting. I felt like trapped, you know. Gave me a bunch of their phone numbers. I was not driving at this point because of legal consequences. And this woman asked me what I was doing the next night. And I don't know why I was shocked, but I really did not recognize that there were lots of AA meetings and that they could be like every day. But she was asking me to go to a meeting the next night. And I was really at that point, I'm 23 years old and I'm not driving, and I was pretty embarrassed about that. And I kind of whispered, I was like, you know, I don't drive. And she laughed at me, and I almost took offense to it. But then she said, "Did you look around? Half the people in this meeting don't drive, and based on age alone. I mean, there were so many super young people in this meeting. It was bizarre." So she comes to pick me up, and the best thing possible happened when she came to pick me up for this meeting the next night. You know, the first night, I'm thinking, you know, there are all these really pretty people. They're all happy. They're all dressed to the nines, I think, anyway. You know, I think all their parents are rich. I mean, it's in McLean, Virginia, which is a nice area. And I'm not. I mean, I had like two outfits, you know what I mean? And so this lady comes to pick me up. She actually called me. She was going to pick me up at like 5 o'clock, and the meeting was 8:30. So I don't know why she's picking me up so early, but she calls me and she says, hey, listen. I'm really sorry. I'm gonna make it there to get you for the meeting, but we ran out of gas, so we're gonna be a little late. And I'm gonna tell you what, none of my friends were calling me and telling me that they weren't gonna show up. None of them like took responsibility. I mean, I would just anxiously wait for people to show up and they just wouldn't show up. You know, I didn't have anybody in my life that really cared if they didn't show up for me. And it was a big deal that she called me. And you know, back then, I mean, she didn't have a cell phone. She had to pull over and get on a payphone. So she comes to get me, and there's a lady in the car with her. And this lady not only was she a little heavier than I was, but she also smelled to high heaven. And I thought, well, this is fantastic, you know, because I thought I was like the worst person in AA. And you know, I just felt completely like I didn't belong in this really pretty group of people. And there was a slate in the car, and I'm like, I think I can do this, you know. And so I kept getting these ladies' phone numbers. I couldn't drive. I thought it was great to not be in the house with my mom, who just, my word. So they just kept rotating, picking me up for meetings. I had this phone list. It had 150 ladies' names on it. And alphabetical order, I was told, listen, if you call every single lady on this list and you cannot get a ride to the meeting, then that's okay. We'll give you a pass. But you got to call everybody on this list before you say, I can't make it to the meeting. So this gal Amanda picked me up like 5 million times for me because yeah, I kept these poor A people, you know. I mean, she just I had these five ladies that just kind of rotated and gave me rides to the meeting. And I'm somebody who I went to a meeting every day for a really long time. I kind of grew up in this home group where people went to a meeting every night. And so I got afraid if I was going to miss something, like that I would get like struck drunk or something would happen. And so for my first 9 years sober, I went to a meeting every day. And then my sponsor's husband, late husband now, saw me like falling asleep in a meeting because I was working. I went to a meeting every night and I would work 105 hours in a week. And I'd just figure out how to make it work. Now I didn't have a husband or kids or anything like that, you know, but I would figure out how, but I would fall asleep in meetings. And so he's like, why don't you go home and do your laundry and sleep? Like, why don't you just take care of yourself? But I needed somebody to give me permission to do that. So I end up running around with these ladies. Now, people are talking about in the meetings I was in, I don't remember people talking about God an awful lot, but I know they did. And I certainly know that I went to step meetings, and they do talk about higher power in the steps. So I'm sure I was hearing it, but I will say part of my spiritual journey in my first 5 years sober is that I would hear the word God or other words that seem similar to me, to God, and I would immediately stop listening to the person in the meeting. I felt like as soon as someone started talking about God, I felt like they had something that I didn't have. It's not that I didn't believe in God. I just felt like I didn't understand it. I wasn't religious. And that if they were talking about God, they had some connection that I had no idea how to have. And it made me really feel less than. And I know that that's not the case, but for 5 years that happened. 4 to 5, you know, what started happening at about like 3 to 5 years is I started working these really long hours. Oh, and the way that that happened, oh my gosh. Okay, so at about at 2 weeks sober, I get an interview for med school.
Oh,
Whoops. Oh yeah, I applied. Oh, forgot about that. So I go to this, and then I start realizing the fog starts. I mean, I was really foggy, very foggy. And so the fog started lifting a little, not completely. I mean, I would say I was really foggy for certainly my first year, if not longer, but definitely my first year sober, I was pretty foggy. I also had really severe insomnia for my whole first year. Anyhow, so I did start recognizing this might be a little ridiculous. I don't think I'm going to get into med school. I don't know what I'm thinking. I mean, I got legal charges. I got, you know, there are all these other perfect people who are applying. It's not easy to get in. So I did start coming up with a backup plan, and this should let you know where my spiritual fitness was at a few months sober. I decided that I did not tell my sponsor because I didn't think that she would find it spiritually fitting. But I decided I would become a professional boxer, that if I didn't get in, I really just love the idea of getting paid to beat the crap out of somebody. I mean, I just love that. I wouldn't go to jail for it. I could legally do this and make money for it, and I'd probably be pretty good because I got a lot of rage down there. So I'm thinking about all that. I'm really involved with my home group. I got service at my home group. I'm going to conferences. I'm going everywhere. And at about 4 months sober, I get this letter saying I'd gotten into med school in Chicago. And I was so fried, I did not realize it wasn't actually in the city of Chicago. It was in this town called North Chicago, which I thought was on the north side of the city of Chicago. North Chicago is actually a small town right next to Waukegan, Illinois, which is where there's a military base, but it's like 45 minutes to an hour north of the city, which means there is no public transportation. So, and I'm not driving. I'm not going to be driving for a long time. Not only would, I mean, I probably could have legally, I could have gotten my license back in like a year, but that's only if you have money. I didn't have any of that. So I couldn't get my act together to get my license back until I had like 3.5 years sober. So for my first 3.5 years, I got rides to meetings every night. Now, moved to Chicago. I didn't know anybody. I was told by my sponsor at that time, she said, listen, I bet you a lot of people have a lot of opinions about what you're about to do. Do you really want to do this? Yeah, I do. And she said, well, listen, if you put God in A first, you can do anything you want. And I think there's God in Chicago. I was like, all right, here we go. So she's like, look, this is what you're going to do. And she like had a plan. She micromanaged me to high heaven. And thank God. I mean, I really, she saved my life. I did not know how to manage my life at all. And I really used my sponsor's a higher power in the beginning. That's what happened for me. And I mean, it worked out. I'm not saying that's right all the time or for everybody or anything like that. But at that time, I could not think straight and I didn't know what I was doing. So she's like, look, international conference is coming up. It's in June. It's in Minneapolis, Minnesota. You got to go. Well, then I pull my card. I always have this card. I pull, well, I'm broke. I don't have any money. Everybody has money. You know, and I all resentful. I had this, it's on my fourth step a lot, like these resentments against rich people, you know, and thinking that they have it easy and da da da. So she said, look, how much money do you think it would take to get you there? Like, how much money do you think you could afford? I totally lowballed her. And I was like, $50. Like, $50. That's it. She's like, all right, be ready. The van's coming. A clown van shows up. And I'm telling you, it is a clown van. I mean, it is the driver has, so the two people that had the most time sober in that van had 5 years sober. The guy that had 5 years sober, he wanted to drive the whole way. He kept getting speeding tickets, but he would not relinquish the wheel. Then there was a girl who was 5 years sober. She was the girl that picked me up that ran out of gas. So she was only slightly unmanageable. And then there was the serial killer guy who you don't really want to talk to. And we had this rule that only one person could smoke at a time, but we let him smoke as much as he wanted to. And he just sat in the back and like chain smoked the entire time. There was the gay couple that like fought the entire time for the entire, I mean, they must have broken up and got back together 4 or 5 times the whole drive. And there's like the 13-year-old girl who has no self-esteem, who's laying on the floorboard of the van because she doesn't feel like she deserves a seat. I mean, there's just every kind of AA in this van. I remember nothing about the international conference. I remember that van ride. I mean, it just, I tried to meet people in Chicago. I met a bunch of people in Chicago, but I was so fried, I didn't know that I wasn't going to be living in Chicago. I mean, I didn't know. So I'd call these people when I got to where I was, you know, to med school, and they're like, dude, you're like 2 hours away. I am sorry, I can't help you. So I started taking cabs to meetings and found out it was a $3 cab ride to the Alamo Club. So I did what I was taught to do. I go to the Alamo Club, introduce myself to everybody. In the back of my mind, I'm a good alcoholic. Where can I get mine? Who has a car? Where can I get my ride? You know, I'm like surveying the land, you know. And nobody was really excited to meet me. I'm sure I wasn't exciting to meet either. But I mean, I was not getting people that were engaging in any way. They were just kind of there, like half alive, you know. And one night, I got a guy who said he would take me home, and I was so excited. I was like, oh my God. So then I get in the car, and then I got the heebie-jeebies, and I was like, oh. He asked me how old I was. I was like, I'm 23. And he said, you know, you got to go, a lot of good drinking left in you. Why don't you just go back out and drink? And I thought because of my experience drink, I thought that something sexually inappropriate might happen, which it did not happen. But the heebie-jeebies was that he was a creep, and you know, I really just needed to get out of the car as quickly as I could. You know what I mean? And but at that time, I only had, you know, a little bit. I had like 6 months sober, and so I really felt like that applied to the whole club, which is not true. But I wasn't really making connections at this club. So my first real God shot that I could see was the next night. I was like, I can't go back to the club. I got to find somewhere else to go to meetings. So I take I my student loans have not come in because they're never on time. I'm just going to tell you, but I have no money. I mean, I'm coming from. Anyway, we don't have money, and so I got $20 left. No student loans are in, and I take a cab to the meeting, this other meeting that I'd never been to, and it was a $15 cab ride. Whoops! Now I'm so fried, I don't realize that's not enough money to get back. Cool. I introduce myself to everybody in the meeting, like I've been taught to do, and I meet the woman who's going to be my sponsor for the next 4 years there. And I never had to take a cab again, a single time. And that was like the first time where I'm like, I didn't orchestrate that. I mean, you could call that stupidity, but I mean, I feel like that was a God shot in my life, and I felt like something was working that I couldn't explain, and I felt taken care of. And I could get with that. And I also felt like, huh, I'm worth getting a ride. Like I started actually feeling like I was worth getting well. And I had not felt that way. So this woman was amazing in my life. She was my sponsor, like I said, for the 4 years I was out there. And we went through our trials and tribulations, which was amazing because it was the first real relationship I'd ever had. I was not somebody that was ever in any romantic relationships. I was one of these gals that would have one night stands with people at the bar while I was intoxicated. Sometimes I would be alert, sometimes I wouldn't. And sometimes I'd come to and recognize that that's not what I wanted happening, but I had no voice. So I had a whole bunch of that stuff happen. But I'd never had any kind of long-standing relationship, friendship, or anything. And this woman was my first friendship. We would have disagreements and she wouldn't leave. The first real problem I had with her was that I was so attached to this woman. I mean, I was used to this other sponsor micromanaging my life. So I would call her every single day and we would go to the meeting together most days. I mean, occasionally I might have someone else pick me up, but it was usually her and I. Her husband was a movie director, so we go to the movies all the time. I mean, she was a friend and a sponsor, and she was just phenomenal. And so one day, the first real intense week I had, where I worked 105 hours in the hospital, it was my first week working in the hospital, and I was doing surgery. And she didn't answer the phone, and she didn't return my call. And I lost my mind. And I went to a meeting. I was taught that if you're thinking about making a big decision, you should share about it, see what other people think about it. If you respect them, shared about it to me. I think I got to get another sponsor. I'm going through a really stressful time. She's not calling me back. Now, mind you, it had been one day that she had not called me. It wasn't like weeks, It was, she didn't immediately call me back. So this woman that I really respected in the meeting came up to me afterwards and she said, I'm just curious how much service work you're doing. And I was infuriated. Because I was like, do you understand that I'm working 105 hours a week? I'm going to a meeting every day. And you're asking me about service. I don't even necessarily hit the same meeting every week. I don't even know how to get service. So I left that meeting pissy and still feeling like I needed to get another sponsor. I woke up the next morning and I called that lady again. And she's like, you could answer phones at the central service office and make your own schedule. And she was like, and Ashley, no one really cares what you do. Your alcoholism doesn't care what you do, and it's going to kill you first. And I was like, oh. And then, of course, within that same day, my sponsor calls me back. And her dad was dying from alcoholism, and he was in the ICU, and she was with her dad. And I felt like the lowest of low. And not only that, but by this point, I was like, maybe that no human power thing. Maybe I need to start establishing some other connection that doesn't rely on one human being. And I started recognizing that maybe my sponsor can't be my God, Now, I didn't get real advanced at it. This is what that looked like for me. What that looked like for me is okay, so it can't be one person. Maybe it could be five. So I developed this top five. This is so ridiculous. It is, it's not. I mean, it works. But I developed this top five list of women. And what they were, is they were all women that had more time sober than I did. And they all had veto power over my life. And they all knew what was going on. They knew my inventory. They knew everything that was going on. so that if I couldn't reach my sponsor, I could reach one of them. And that never failed. I mean, I really could reach any one of them. Eventually that had to evolve too. So anyway, what happened is I really didn't recognize how much going to school and being so focused on school would take away from me having relationships in my life. And that if you're a workaholic, you don't really have time to develop relationships in your life. And that's really what I did. I mean, working as much as I did, I then decided I wanted to come back to kind of the DMV area. And I got really scared. Like, this was the first time that I started questioning. I felt like I had like imposter syndrome. Like, they were going to just find out who I was and they were going to ask me to leave. And I had this advisor at school, and he asked me where I wanted to go for residency. And I was like, well, it doesn't really, I don't really know where it's going to take me. Like, what do you think about safety schools? What does that look like, for residency? And he's like, why do you think you need a safety school? Why don't you just pick where you want to go? And I was like, well, and I told him about my alcoholism. I told him that I had this legal record that had not quite come out when I had gotten accepted to medical school, and that it would all come out. And he's like, well, why don't you just do an elective there and then work your tail off while you're there and let them actually get to know you, and know you as a person? Because quite frankly, there are a lot of doctors out there that are terrible people, and you're not really a terrible person. So why don't you just go check it out? I was like, all right. And I really thought that he was joking. And so I was like, you know what, I'll go to Hopkins. I was just like laughing almost. So, like, that's unrealistic. But I had somebody else suggest I should go there. And I'd had weird experiences with having to deal with alcoholics in the hospital. I'd had the experience of I worked at Cook County Hospital in Chicago, and it was like the old Cook County that was like on ER, where like people were prostituting themselves in the stairwell. I mean, it was crazy. And the doctors would make the alcoholics in DTs a show. They treated them horribly. They were like, maybe if they have a seizure, they won't drink again. And so they showed us this alcoholic in really bad withdrawal. And I thought, oh, like, I just have to hide part of me. Like, does he recognize that he's talking about me? And so I go to Hopkins for this elective, and it was the first hospital setting where the psychiatrist was talking about Alcoholics Anonymous. And not only was he talking about it, he was talking to this guy that had come in, and he didn't just say Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, well, have you ever been to meetings before? He's like, okay, well, that's great. Well, did you have a sponsor? Like, how far did you go in the steps? What happened? Oh, so you didn't get to a fourth and a fifth step. Well, no wonder you didn't. I mean, he was talking to him like he was another member of AA, and he actually wasn't. I asked him later, and he wasn't. And I thought, huh, this is crazy. And I was like, how come? I decided just to quiz him a little. I was like, how come you talk about AA the way that you do with patients? I haven't heard anything like it. And he said, well, because modern medicine's terrible and we don't have a cure for alcoholism, and AA is the best thing we've got. And so I better be talking about to people not from a pharmaceutical company, but from what is the best thing that we have to offer through proof and evidence and research. And it's Alcoholics Anonymous. It's the best thing we got. And I was sold. I was like, wow, they talk like normal people. Their beliefs line up with my, anyway, I gotta speed this up. So I get this call, and I didn't know. Again, I don't think it's going to happen. I get this call, and they say it's the admissions people from Hopkins, the residency program, and they're like, "Listen, we're not allowed to tell anybody before match day. Match day is March 15th. We're not allowed to tell anybody before match day whether or not we're ranking them or not. The only person we're allowed to tell is our number one pick of that season, and you're our number one pick this season." And I was floored. 2 weeks later, I get the application in the mail, because they then send you the hospital application to work there, where it asks all my legal stuff. Call the guy back. It's like, listen, I'm filling out this application, and it asks for my legal history. And I need for you to know that I'm a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. I can provide you with a letter from my sponsor. I don't know what you want, but it's going to ask me all these legal questions, and it's not going to look very good on paper. And he laughed. And he said, you know, if we didn't let people be doctors who had issues with alcoholism or mental illness, we wouldn't have any, which was horrifying. But he was like, you're fine, dude. Come on. And so I went through, I ended up going there, but I don't want to make this about my career because it's not about that. It actually is about how God has transformed my life. And I honestly think that, you know, what we initially think is a purpose or a reason for things is not always what it is. And so, you know, what's happened for me is, yeah, I did meet a guy in AA. Well, I did serial dating first. You got to do that first. I like 3.5 years sober, I was not working as much, and I realized, oh, you know, maybe I should date. Well, I didn't know how to date. I knew how to like have sex, and then, oh, is this dating? I mean, I just didn't know what to do. And so I'd have like a couple months here, 3 months there, a couple months, and I'd have somebody on the back burner while I'm breaking up with the guy. I mean, I was a mess. And so finally, like, my friend and I were single at the same time, and we didn't date, nothing. We just all of a sudden kind of looked at each other and we're like, all right, let's go. And that's my husband. So we've been together now for, oh my word, since 2006. And we got married when we had 5 years together. Now that might sound magical. Let me tell you, it was not. We had a couples therapist before we even got married. That's never a good sign, I'm going to tell you. I mean, we were a mess. You know, we were two alcoholics. Sometimes we're behaving in a sober fashion, and sometimes we're not. And we have not been so kind to each other. I love that man to my core, and I hope he is my partner till my death. But we have not been kind to each other over the years. And we've created distrust. I mean, right after we got married, I ended up, so I lived with him and his mom was severely medically ill a lot. And so I felt like I was kind of on call all the time. Almost had to do CPR on her, but the ambulance came in time. And it was stressful. And so we get married, and I'm thinking, well, now I'm the number one woman, right? And I wasn't. And it felt weird. And so I started, you know, I'm like, well, I just need to hang out with my girlfriends. Let me just go fellowship. Let me do that. Well, then I started hanging out with the guy from the sober softball team that I was on. And next thing you know, I'm only married 2 months and I'm having an emotional affair with this other man. Now, my peculiar mental twist in my mind says, I have not physically touched this man, so I don't think I've done anything wrong. Mind you, I've completely all loyalty to my husband being my emotional partner has gone out the window, and he now no longer trusts me. Kicks me out of the house. I'm out of the house for a month. Starts talking about divorce. We're 2 years or 2 months married. 2 months. He starts talking about divorce. So, but then, you know, things come back and we kind of do this, you know. And then, you know, his mom dies and we come together in crisis because that's what we do. And then we decide, you know what, maybe we should start having kids. Now, I did not want to have kids because what happened for me is at 4 years sober, I got pregnant again. And I terminated a second pregnancy. And what happened at that time is I lost my mind. I wanted to kill myself for a brief period of time. I should have sought outside help, and I did not. I lived on my sponsor's couch for a month. And she kind of literally put me back together and told me when to shower, told me when to go to meetings, and just took me along. That was in Chicago. So, I just didn't have a good example as a mom. I didn't want to be that person. I didn't want to be the mom that was so ill and so neglectful that she just let her daughter be sexually abused by the neighbor nonstop. I didn't want to be that mom. So I started having, and I have to wrap this up. We started having kids, and we discovered that our first daughter, there was something wrong with her. At about 9 months old, she just there's something wasn't right. Well, she has a genetic disorder. Whole bunch of things going on. Epilepsy, really bad ADHD, executive dysfunction, autism, you know, a whole bunch of stuff. And I'm going to tell you, I thought that God was punishing me for terminating these pregnancies. And I had to have a complete realignment with God. I had to go through the steps again. I had to go through the steps again with a different person. I just needed another perspective. And interestingly, it all kind of came to fruition when my dad, of all people, who is the non-emotional football player, said, I think it's so amazing that Sasha chose you and Deshu to be her parents because you're the only ones that can take care of her the way that you do. And look at that. I'm this highfalutin bigwig at Hopkins, chair of a department who has all the doctors I need at my fingertips. I had an appointment for her in less than 24 hours from Hopkins. Like, how does that happen? You know? So I believe I also I'll just say really quick, a few years ago during the pandemic, I've always worked in the hospital. I love the hospital. It's crazy. I love it. And I'm an adrenaline junkie. So working in the hospital during COVID, I'm just going to tell you, it was a new level. It was hard. And it was me being the connector for people in my home group to be with other people when they weren't well, because for a long time there were like no visitors, so I was the visitor for everyone. And that was really hard. So I had a hard time coming out of that, and I didn't behave well yet again. I'm not talking to my sponsor because she talks too long. I don't have enough time. She talks for an hour. I love this woman, but she talks for an hour. I had to get a new sponsor. I had to almost go through a divorce. I mean, just things shattered again. And I've been trying to rebuild my recovery and my spiritual connection. I started going on this retreat that I have seen Sam at, and other people at, and I'm constantly striving to have a better connection so that I don't have to feel alone, and I don't have to feel like I have to go through. My first thought is still wrong most of the time, and I really do need some kind of spiritual guidance. I got a new sponsor a few years ago, and the reason I got her is because she has a peace and calm about her that I want. I love that I'm direct, but can I not be so sharp? Can we like take a little bit of the edge off? Like there are ways that we can that I could be softened. That this woman is. So I'm just so grateful that I'm here, grateful to be sober. And I hope that that came through. Thanks for letting me share.